Yeah, okay. Of course. So.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's now 5:05. On behalf of CDSTD, I'd like to welcome you to our event today. My name is Niu Qiang. I will be moderating this discussion. And before starting today's panel discussion with our distinguished guests, please allow me to briefly introduce the organizer of today's event, China Development Student Think Tank. CDSTT is an international organization headquartered in Syracuse, New York. CDSTT is dedicated to promoting intellectual, cultural, and social activities for American and Chinese students, scholars, and other interested parties. CDSTT facilitates academic communication between China and the United States by providing forums, seminars, field research regarding China's political and economic reforms, U.S.-China relations, and sustainable development in the Asia-Pacific region. CDSTT's GW chapter was established in November last year and serves as a student think tank that provides a platform for GW students to gain knowledge and share their own perspectives on topics of common concern. To learn about this organization or potentially join us, please come talk to CDSTT e-board members after the panel discussion. Thank you very much. In addition, we would also like to thank the Cigar Center at GW for their help to make today's event happen. So our topic today is very timely. I think for most of us, we would agree that since Chinese President Xi Jinping came to power, we have seen the China foreign policy shifting from a biding our time sort of policy towards a more progressive one. And since now we have seen that Chinese leadership has formed a new foreign policy team last month during the two sessions, and as President Xi officially started his second term, it's now a good time to have an overall review of China's foreign policy transition. Today we have three distinguished guests joining us. Allow me now to briefly introduce them. On my far right is Professor Xin Qiang. Professor Xin is currently a visiting scholar at SAIS Johns Hopkins University, a PhD graduate from the School of International Relations at Fudan University. He now serves as the director at the Center of Taiwan Studies and a deputy director at the Center for American Studies of Fudan University. And next, thank you. Of U.S.-China relations, cross-strait relations, American politics, and maritime security, Professor Xin has written and co-edited numerous books on Taiwan issues, U.S. congressional decision-making process, and its impact on U.S. foreign policy. He has also translated many books on the theory of international politics. His remarks and articles have appeared on both major Chinese and international media outlets. Next to Professor Xin is Professor Robert Sutter. Robert Sutter is Professor of Practice of International Affairs at the Elliott School of George Washington University. His earlier full-time position was Visiting Professor of Asian Studies at Georgetown University. A PhD graduate in History and East Asian Languages from Harvard University, Professor Sutter has published 21 books, over 200 articles, and several hundred government reports dealing with contemporary East Asian and Pacific countries and their relations with the United States. His most recent book is the third edition of U.S.-China Relations, Perilous Past, Uncertain Present. From 1968 to 2001, Professor Sutter's government career saw service as the director of the Foreign Affairs and National Defense Division of the Congressional Research Service. He was also the National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and the Pacific at the U.S. government's National Intelligence Council, and the China Division Director at the Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. Thank you, Robert. Finally, we have Professor David Shambo. David Shambaugh received his PhD on political science from University of Michigan and is currently a professor of international affairs and political science at Elliott School at George Washington University. He is a widely recognized authority on China's foreign policy, military and security issues, as well as Chinese politics. He held many important positions in academic institutions, including the Brookings Institution and Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He also served on the board of directors of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations and has been elected a member of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, Council on Foreign Relations, U.S.-Asia-Pacific Council, and other public policy organizations. Thank you for joining us. Now, finally, for today's panel discussion, we will ask our speakers to each give a 10 to 20 minute speech, after which I will probably take advantage of my moderator role to follow up with one or two questions, and then we will open up the floor to the audience. And we hope to end our session at 6:30 sharp today. Now, without further ado, let's start with Professor Shambaugh.
Time. Thank you, Mr. Neal, for the nice introductions, and to CDSTT for organizing today's session. It's a new acronym I have to memorize, CDSTT. And welcome to the George Washington campus. This is, I think, the third branch of the organization on American university campuses. Can you all hear me, by the way? Okay. So 20 minutes maximum is not very much time to talk about 40 years of anything, much less Chinese foreign policy. It's a huge topic. So I'm just going to try and give you some kind of key takeaway impressions of my own. I've been studying Chinese foreign policy throughout this period. In fact, that's when I started in the field, was during the Deng Xiaoping, actually in the Mao period. Anyway, Professor Sutter and I have discussed a little bit of a division of labor. I'm going to try and take the story from Deng up to Xi Jinping, and then he will take over with Xi Jinping in the more contemporary period. And then we're going to have some reflections from our Chinese, from a Chinese perspective, Professor Chang. So let me start off, as I say, it's not easy to try and summarize that period of time. There have been a lot of zigs and zags during this period. And I suppose that's the first takeaway, is that China's foreign policy throughout these past four decades has been anything but consistent. It has been quite inconsistent in many respects. But, of course, if you ask the Chinese government, they will always say, oh, everything's consistent. We never waver from our principles. We're always upholding the five principles of peaceful coexistence and so on and so forth. But when I look back over the last four decades of Chinese foreign policy, there have been a lot of changes and ups and downs that have reflected both changes in China and Chinese leadership, but also changes in the world. But I guess if you look back over this period of time, there are some other continuities within these discontinuities. The first is, as I think Mr. Neo just said, China's foreign policy has evolved from passive to proactive. That's one big takeaway. It's not like, and certainly the Xi Jinping period is more proactive than ever. But that didn't just happen when Xi Jinping came to power. It's been a progressive process. But as Professor Sutter will probably discuss, we are into a new era, of Xi Jinping thought and Chinese characteristics in diplomacy. So that's one continuity. Another continuity, I would say, over the most of these four decades is China's been very reactive to the world. It's not been not necessarily been proactive. It's only now, under the Xi Jinping period, we see China really going out and trying to set and participate more fully in the international agenda setting and community, particularly in global governance. Global governance is a part of diplomacy where China's been extremely ambivalent and suspicious. But under Xi Jinping, we see a very new period, a very more positive period, much more active and contributing to a whole range of transnational global governance issues. So from passivity to more proactiveness, from reactiveness to more proactiveness, China's been, through most of this period, I would say, very tactically flexible and very pragmatic, as it had to be. Another continuity over the period is the centrality of the United States in China's foreign policy, both bilaterally but also regionally in Asia and now globally. That's the big change over the last four decades and even the last 5 years, is China is now a global actor. That was not the case really until the Hu Jintao period. But now that China is a global actor, the U.S.-China relationship has added a new global dimension in addition to the long-standing regional and bilateral dimensions. Okay, so the U.S. has been pretty central in China's thinking. Another continuity is that despite progressive institutional integration into more than 180, I think, international governmental organizations, China has exhibited, as I say, continuing ambivalence about its role in global governance. It's beginning to change under Xi Jinping. It's a very positive change, and China hopefully is shedding, leaving behind this ambivalence and suspiciousness, and is now really beginning to act with confidence on the world stage. That's a good thing. We welcome it. In fact, we in the West have been calling for it for several decades, and we're really pleased that China is now becoming increasingly a responsible international stakeholder. And then the last continuity I see over the four decades, of course, is that economic development needs inside of China have really been the driving factor for everything, including diplomacy. Deng Xiaoping made that very clear at the third plenary session in December 1978 when he came back to power after his third purge by Mao. He said, you know, we have to modernize, we have to develop our country, and we have to focus every effort like a laser beam on that national goal. And for diplomacy, that meant a number of things that I'll talk about. But it was an effort, it's been an effort for decades, you might say, to make China strong again. So that continues. Okay, so if we look back over these three leaders, Deng, Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, as I say, Professor Sutter will talk about Xi Dada, but the other three, and you really have to say five, because during the Deng period, he was the grand strategist behind China's foreign policy, but the there were other two other really important leaders that were quite involved, namely Zhao Ziyang. How many of you remember Zhao Ziyang? Nobody. Oh, a couple people. Yeah, well, if you don't remember him, I know why. The Chinese government has done its best to whitewash Zhao Ziyang from its official history. Hu Yaobang, also a very important leader during his time in office in the 1980s, before he too was purged in 1987. Zhao Ziyang was purged in 1989. So we've really got five leaders here. So what can we say about them? The Deng period, first of all. Well, Deng, what did he inherit when he took over? Internally, he inherited a poor, backward, traumatized, and totalitarian society. China was a mess in the late 1970s. I know. I lived there. I was a student there in those years. Long way from what it is today. And externally, China was isolated. Internally, it was poor, backward, traumatized, totalitarian. Externally, it was isolated in the world. It had only begun to take baby steps out into the international arena following the opening with the United States, which then facilitated China's opening of relations with West European and Asian countries. But even when Deng Xiaoping took over, most Asian countries did not yet have diplomatic relations with China. So first thing Deng had to do was to reform and open up, to start this process of normalization, you might say, with other governments. Before Deng came to power, China had, in many parts of the world, at least in Asia and Africa, been trying to overthrow governments by supporting insurgent movements, armed groups, in opposition to established governments and states. So he changed that immediately, 1978, and China stopped that process and opened relations with a number of governments around Asia, around China's periphery. It's hard to believe today, but in 1978, China didn't have much relations with its periphery. The open door was a driving process there. More broadly, internationally, this was a period when the Soviet Union was quite aggressive, increasingly aggressive, the so-called Beijing, the polar bear, and the United States and China and other countries were coalescing into a global united front to combat Soviet hegemony and aggressiveness in Africa, and towards Europe, in Asia, and elsewhere. So the alignment between China and the United States during this period was very, very tight, very, very close. Then we had, during the Deng period, difficulties, you might say, between China and Vietnam. China attacked Vietnam in 1979. It's the last war China fought. And it didn't do so well, actually, for the People's Liberation Army. So Deng started off facing enormous challenges on its periphery in Asia, more broadly with the Soviet Union. And then after, I would say, 1982 to 80, throughout the 80s, things began to stabilize, and China, under Zhao Ziyang and Hu Yaobang, really did integrate itself into the international community. It began to join the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the other Bretton Woods organizations, and other multilateral institutions around the world. That was a process that began in the 80s. It actually took about 20 years to complete. But it was a good initiative during that time. And so the 80s, I think, if you look back on Chinese foreign policy under Zhao Ziyang and under Deng, was primarily a real success story. And then came Liu Si, June 4th, 1989. It absolutely shattered China's emergence, well, shattered China's relations with the West and this process I just described of China's integration into the world. It was a traumatic event, both for China, for the Chinese regime, and for China's relations with other countries. And it took really 5 years for China to overcome the isolation, the sanctions, the stigma of June 4th. But by the mid, and now we're into the Jiang Zemin period, okay? Jiang Zemin takes over just in the aftermath of June 4th, after Zhao Ziyang had been purged and sent into house arrest for the rest of his life until he died. And Jiang Zemin, you know, had no experience with foreign policy. Talk about a tough job getting thrown into the fire. Baptism under fire, they say. So how do we look back on the Jiang Zemin era? I think you can divide that into two kind of sub-periods. The first is the immediate post-89 period, it lasts up till 1994-95, where the major task was to normalize China's relations with the West in particular, get out of the deep freeze, the diplomatic deep freeze that it was in the wake of June 4th, and build its ties with its own neighbors in Asia. This is towards the end of the 90s, we really see China's concentration and sort of prioritization on the Asian region. The Asian financial crisis was a big part of that. It was an opportunity. It was a traumatic event for Asian economies, Indonesia, Thailand, South Korea, and others. China was economically insulated from that event, but it was an opportunity for China to reach out and help its neighbors, Thailand and Indonesia and South Korea included. And that paid dividends for China over the next decade. But let's, before we leave the Jiang Zemin period, I guess two other or three other things to note. One was the return of Hong Kong and Macau to China's sovereignty, and the end of the colonial periods in both of those localities. Secondly, was the stabilization of relations with the United States. And even though very fragile, they began to have at least procedural interaction again until, this is the third development under the Jiang Zemin period, the Taiwan Straits crises of 1995-96, when China began to lob missiles at Taiwan. And that was, of course, not a very positive development, and it caused great strains again in relations with the U.S. But after the 96 crisis and the end of the Clinton administration, Jiang Zemin came here to the United States. President Clinton went to China, and by the time he left office, Clinton, that is, the relationship had kind of re-stabilized itself. And then finally, during the Jiang period, we see the beginning of relations with India, and improved relations certainly with Russia, post-Soviet Russia. Jiang Zemin himself had been educated in Russia, spoke Russian, could sing Russian songs, liked to drink vodka. He had many talents, Jiang Zemin. Still does. Still with us. He could recite the Gettysburg. He was a multilingual person. He spoke, you know, okay English. He could recite the Gettysburg Address, which he did to President Bush. You know, looking back on it, certainly on the Jiang Zemin era, certainly internally, we have to say the Jiang Zemin period was a reformist period, politically reformist, as well as economically reformist. And externally, in terms of Chinese foreign policy, I give Jiang Zemin pretty high marks, I think. He turned over to Hu Jintao, and let me just close and with some discussion about that period. Hu Jintao inherited a much better situation in Chinese diplomacy than Jiang Zemin inherited when he came to power. So Hu Jintao could build on that, you know, foundation and restabilization. And that's what he did. If I think back about the 10 years from 2002 to 2012, or at least I would say 7 of those 10 years, from 2002 to 2009, we really see an expansion of China's relations all over the world. And, you know, Hu Jintao was sort of dismissed as a, you know, not terribly effectual leader. I think over time, history may see him as more effective than the current period has, and particularly in foreign policy. And if you look at his domestic policies in his first term as well. So in foreign policy, what do I mean by that? Well, it was under Hu Jintao that China had a more omnidirectional, multi-directional foreign policy. China really began to go global under Hu Jintao. Latin America, more in Africa, Middle East, Central Asia, Europe. These were areas that had not been prioritized for China previously. China had no real presence in any of those places except Africa. But Hu Jintao redirected Chinese foreign policy away from the West, I would argue, and towards the global South and towards Europe. Of course, Europe had become one again after 1991. And the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was also a very traumatic experience for Chinese diplomacy. I think Mr. Niu mentioned the Taiwan Yanhui, bide your time, hide your brightness, Bu Dang Kou, do not take the lead. Well, that Deng Xiaoping said that, when did he say that? He said that right after June 4th, in fact, and then he repeated it after the Soviet Union collapsed. So that was a rather searing event for China, but back to Hu Jintao briefly, and I'll try and finish. We see a reorientation, geographic reorientation, I would argue, away from an emphasis on the West to an emphasis on the global South, and really the whole globe. And it's also during this period that China's relations with Asia went through what was known as the Golden Decade, 1998 to 2008. Okay, so why do I say only 7 out of 10 years? because in 2009, for reasons that are still unclear, if we can ever get access to the Chinese state archives, we may be able to answer this question. We'll never get access to the Chinese state archives, so we'll never be able to answer the question.